I respectfully refuse to answer that question, as my truthful answer may tend to incriminate me.
This is Larry Henry, author of The Mafia Chronicles, and you're listening to Gangland Wire.
Former Kansas City Police Department intelligence detective and now attorney Gary Jenkins produced four documentary films, most recently Gangland Wire, creator of smartphone app entitled Kansas City Mob Tours. Download it now. If you like what you hear, go to ganglandwire.com. Navigate to the shop page. We need you to put a hit out on our donate button. Gangland Wire True Crime Stories is produced at the Big Dumb Fun Show Studio 4. And now, here's Gary Jenkins.
Well, good evening, all you wiretappers out there. We're here in the classic old Ice House building in Midtown, Kansas City. I'm here with my good friend and co-host, Aaron. Say hello, Aaron.
Hello, Aaron.
And we have, waiting patiently on the line here, our new friend, Joan Renner of Deranged LA Crimes. It's a true crime blog site. Joan, it's great to have you here tonight.
Oh, it's wonderful to be here. Thank you for having me.
You know, before we really get started, I need to say one thing about a fan. Joan and I, whenever we fans will interact with us quite often on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and all the different social media platforms, is, and I think you've got some familiarity with that, don't you?
Definitely.
Yeah, and I had we did a show about the Friday night bank robber the other night, and I mentioned in that it just got released, and that somebody, a fan, had suggested that to me, and I liked the story, and I did it. I couldn't remember who it was, so the next day, or a couple of days later, I get a Facebook message that reminds me that was Jason Lopes. So Jason Lopes of Reno, Nevada, giving you due credit here for your suggestion on the Friday night bank robber. Thank you very much. So, Joan, we're going to talk about the Rufy Romeos tonight, but first, that's a story that you did, and I found. I'm a dedicated reader of Joan's blog, which I would suggest any of you guys out there that like true crime, you're going to find some different, interesting stories. It's not going to be the same old stories that everybody else has done and redone. These are some different stories, and it's really written in an interesting way in which you can follow along easily and provide some good insights. But Joan, tell us a little bit more about how you got interested in this true crime thing.
And what's the name of your blog?
Yeah, the name of my blog is Deranged LA Crimes. And I started getting interested in true crime when I was a kid. I'm from Chicago originally, so maybe that has something to do with it. I became interested when I was a kid. I was about 8 years old, maybe. A boy about my age went missing. And I used to read the newspaper. A lot of it went over my head. I don't know what I was doing. But this story really grabbed my attention because it was a little boy my own age. And he went missing, and he was later found. He'd been murdered. So I followed the story. A little bit later after that, they talked about, in the paper, they talked about the father who had died of a broken heart. Really, I found that really hard to understand as a kid. I didn't understand if your heart just literally broke in two or if it shattered or what happened. And I wanted to understand better how someone could cause that much pain to someone else. And it stuck with me. It stuck with me to this day. And that, I think, was my original interest in true crime. And from then on, I read fiction, true crime, anything to do with bad behavior.
Well, that's fascinating. You know, Joan, in a parallel universe almost, and this was a little before that, this was in 1955, 54 probably, there was a boy kidnapped here in Kansas City, and they found him dead in the city. I lived out in a small town outside the city, and they found this little boy murdered and buried in the backyard of one of the kidnappers' homes in St. Joe, Missouri, which was pretty close to my home. And it was like, I remember everything about that because he was the same age I was. It was, I don't know, there was something about that impacts, I think, a little kid when they, they can relate to the victim, which many times you can't relate to an adult victim, but you can relate to a kid.
Well, too, and as a kid, you know, you're still discovering the world around you, and you know that there, you know, maybe there are really boogeymen. You don't really know, but you have that sense of immortality and invincibility in some ways. And then when you hear of another kid being harmed, it starts to change your world, you know, your worldview just a little bit. It's like, oh, well, if that happened to him, does that mean it could happen to me?
Really?
And it's very unsettling for a kid, I think.
Yeah, I didn't get that sense of immortality back until I was about 16, 15 years old, and then I thought I was immortal again.
And then it comes back with a vengeance.
With a vengeance, yes.
Everyone's intolerable. Yeah,
yes.
Everyone's intolerable at that age.
And I can do anything, and I can live forever. So,
a lot of parents were kind of thankful for Bobby Greenlee's kidnapping because it really kept a lot of other kids in line.
Yeah, that's what Aaron said, the Bobby Greenlee's kidnapping.
Well, that's the thing. You always say, yeah, your parents would say, you know that kid, you
yeah,
know, and if you don't behave, oh, thanks a lot for that.
Tell us a little bit about your career. I noticed in your bio that, of course, you know, I'm a retired Kansas City, Missouri police officer, and I've done some work for our Kansas City Police Historical Society, mm-hmm. and I like taped all the former living chiefs telling kind of the story of their career, put them in an archive. We don't really have a museum or anything like you do, but you've had some experience with that out there in L.A.
Yeah. I worked for 6.5 years as a volunteer at the Los Angeles Police Museum, and it was really rewarding. I liked it. Retired makes it sound like I'm not doing anything. I don't know if you find that or not, but if I say I'm retired, people just get this image of me sipping a cold drink with an umbrella in it. And that's not what my life is.
Yeah.
So I usually just say I changed careers because that's actually more accurate. I changed careers in 2008 and became a writer and a tour guide. And also I started volunteering the next year for the Los Angeles Police Museum, and they trained me there as an archivist. So I was able to work with their collection of police daily bulletins, the bulletins go back to 1907, March 1907. And our collection spanned about not every single year, not every day, but we had a really good representative collection from 1907 to about 1958. And they're astonishing. I mean, I'm sure most police departments had the same kind of thing, especially before radio communications and then computers. They'd have the thing that they'd pass out at the beginning of each shift and let you know basically what's going on. Who, you know, is anyone wanted? Are there any stolen cars? Is, you know, this and that. And the bulletins were just a whole, just documents looking into the city. You could see everything about the city, everything about what the police were doing, from catching bank robbers to being reminded to listen to Calling All Cars on the radio. So it's an astonishing, they're astonishing documents. I love that. We also, with the executive director at the time, Glenn Martin, he and the author, I'm sure you know, and I think your listeners probably will know too, James Ellroy, who wrote L.A. Confidential and My Dark Places, among others, books. He and the executive director, Glenn Martin, had wanted for the longest time to begin a publishing program for the museum, which is really, I mean, it was really a special idea because for a small museum, it's unheard of, basically, and for a museum that's as specific as a police museum, it's really unknown. With James' support and Glenn's expertise and knowledge, they approached the police chief, Charlie Beck, with the idea, and he said, go ahead. So we wanted to do a book with crime scene photos, but we wanted them to be black and white. We didn't want them to be gory, but we wanted them to show cops at work. Kind of, or you know, the kinds of things that they encountered. So we started going through, weren't sure if we were going to do an overview of decades or what, but as we started going through photographs and setting aside the ones that we really thought had merit, we realized that there was one stack that was growing larger than the others. And the thing that the large stack all had in common was the year 1953. Well, for some reason, 1953 was a really interesting year in Los Angeles for crime. And because anyone who knows James Ellroy's work knows that that is a really, that's his sweet spot, is the 50s.
Oh, yeah.
And in there, and that's what he, you know, what he mostly writes about, what he's really familiar with. I mean, he's got an amazing memory, an amazing grasp of crime in L.A. And
I was going to say, the Black
yeah,
Dahlia is kind of a
yeah, the Black
Dahlia
was 1947.
I wouldn't say that again, Aaron.
It is, because his mother was murdered. His mother's murder is unsolved, just like the Dahlia case. His mother was murdered in June of 1958, and the Black Dahlia was murdered in January of 1947. Both are still unsolved homicides. And so it really resonates with James quite a bit. But it was just so much fun to do the book. We worked as a team, and James wrote all the narrative. It's very much of his style and his sensibility. And we selected, I think, some pretty interesting photos. I know.
his
sensibility
style.
It might be an acquired taste, but I personally find it really, I really love the way he writes. And it was just a lot of fun to work together. And so the book came out a couple of years ago. It's called LAPD 53.
Is that available?
And it's a very interesting collection of stories. It is. It's available. You can get it online. You can get it through Amazon. And it's just an interesting look at, just a look at L.A. in 1953 through some of its crimes. Some of its more unusual or bizarre or notable crimes. Just interesting stuff. It was a lot of fun to do.
I have to ask Gary this. Maybe he knows the year that the two Charlies were killed out in L.A. Was that...
No, 50? No, there's the two Tonys.
The two Tonys. The two Tonys were definitely... That's one of my favorite crime scene photos ever.
Really?
The two Tonys.
That's a good one.
Tony Brancato. Yeah, the two Tonys were... They found out later on that Jimmy the Weasel...
Fratiano, yeah.
Fratiano. He copped to it later on, obviously not when he turned, when he became a, and when he went into witness protection, I think he copped to that. He copped to that double homicide in a car on a street in Hollywood.
That would have been one of his early crimes, in which he probably maybe even made his bone, shall we say, and got his button, or got inducted into the mafia at that point in time, I believe, because of those two murders.
It's quite possible. I mean, I know that the Tonys, they'd done something very stupid. They'd robbed a casino in Las Vegas. Well, I mean, you're robbing from your bosses, really.
Yeah,
and
really.
As you know, in gangland, that does not go over well. And there's when you do that, there are consequences, and they're usually fatal. And in this case, for the Tonys, definitely fatal. But that's and that's, like I said, one of my favorite crime scene photos of all time is the two Tonys in their car.
Really interesting. Well, now what else have you done? I see that you've done some stuff on the Discovery Channel.
I have. Well, and I wanted to also say that I'm working now with the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department Museum. I'm working with their historian, and we're putting together a small satellite museum in the somewhat recently reopened and rededicated Hall of Justice. It was initially opened in the 1920s, and it had been closed for a number of years after an earthquake. But they refurbished it, redid it. It's open, and it now houses the Sheriff's Department and the District Attorney. Initially, it housed the sheriff, the DA, and the coroner. So the small museum inside the Hall of Justice is going to have artifacts from all three of those original entities. And then we're going to have the Sheriff's Department's going to have a dedicated museum in what was formerly Sybil Brand Institute, which was the
women's jail for Los Angeles County. It's been out of commission for many years now. The sheriff still owns it. They still use it for things, but it hasn't been used as a jail. So that's really interesting. I'm really happy to be continuing my work with that stuff because I love the history. I love the history of law enforcement. I feel very fortunate to be involved in that.
That's going to be a pretty good size museum then, sounds to me like, if it's in a former women's county jail.
Yeah, it is. They still use a lot of it for different things, but we've been able to, Sheriff McDonald let us carve out a pretty large footprint for the museum. So we're going to have vehicles, a helicopter, lots of exhibits. We have a cell where one of the Manson girls was incarcerated in 1969. So there's all kinds of interesting stuff we're going to have on display there. A lot of good history.
And that's going to be open sometime later this year or early part of next year?
No, I wish. Probably sometime next year.
Okay.
We were shooting for this year, but unfortunately, you know how things go. Everything always takes longer than people think it's going to take. But next year, I think we'll be able to do it.
Yeah, tell us a little more about some of the other things that you've done. As I said before, I see that you've been on the Discovery Channel a few times.
I've been on the Investigation Discovery Channel a little over 20 times, I guess, for different shows. I've been interviewed for Deadly Women, Deadly Affairs, Evil Twins, Evil Kin, Nightmare Next Door, Dark Places, Hell House. If it's got deadly or evil in the title, I'm probably going to be in it at some point. And I recently appeared in something that aired the other night on the Cecil Hotel in Los Angeles, which has been it's housed two serial killers in its in its history. So
I was going to say, does Discovery have a show called How I Got a Volunteer Job at the LA Police Department Archives? That'd be an interesting story in itself.
Oh, gosh. There's so much. I mean, the history is just, people sometimes dismiss Los Angeles as having no particular, I don't know, it's sort of like we're all superficial. And it's not necessarily the case because, to be honest, until the last few years, population of Los Angeles was made up primarily of people from someplace else. This has always been a place where people either ran to from something, or they just wanted to start a new life in a climate that was a little more forgiving than, you know, than the snowbound winters back east.
Sounds like a good place to do tours. And then it also says here in Gary's notes that you have some lectures that you do on some specific topics.
Yeah, I've done. Yes, I've done. I've done some lectures. I did one. I called it Felonious Flappers. I'm really interested in the whole sociological aspect of the women's movement in the when women really got the vote in the 20s and around then, like the flappers and all the stuff that led up to that, and that whole period between the world wars, I think, is really interesting. So I gave a lecture on Felonious Flappers, and these were all women who had behaved very badly, most of them killers, in that between the war period. And that was fun. But I've given lectures on the Black Dahlia case, and I was invited to give a lecture at the California Criminalists Association a couple of years. I've spoken there twice. I'm really honored to do that because these people are the real deal. I mean, they're criminalists. They're out working in the field. It's CSI. it's interesting. I was really honored to be asked a couple of times to speak to them, and that's cool. So I do a lot of that kind of thing.
So let's move along to the Rufy Romeos. I saw that and I started reading on your blog, your Deranged LA Crime blog, and it's like, oh my God, you see, you know, I'm a little bit older and we didn't have such a thing as roofies. I never heard of roofies until sometime in the last few years. And it's like, well, what kind of a person would do that? But I guess you're going to help explain what kind of a person does that.
Well, I can tell you in just a couple of words, depraved, and hateful. Human beings are the only people who would do that. Roofies refers to Rohypnol, which is a sedative that's actually extremely powerful. It renders the person virtually a zombie. And that's why these two guys, they were twin brothers. They're still alive. Twin brothers living in Canada. They're George and Stefan Spitzer. I think their case was, if not the first in the United States, definitely one of the first in which someone was tried for using a date rape drug, which is what Rohypnol is. And they're just really, really sick individuals.
So when did their like serial date rapers or serial date rapists, when did they start? Kind of what are the circumstances? Where did they come from?
Well, originally they were born in Romania in 1956. They were the sons of two Holocaust survivors, actually. And their parents had hidden from the Nazis in Bucharest. They moved from Romania. Finally, they moved to Greece. They moved around a little bit. Their mom died in 1975. And then I think their father took the family to Canada. And they lived there, and that's where they grew up. But when the boys got a little older, they visited Los Angeles on vacation. I think it was in the early 80s. And they fell in love with it. And both of them, if you don't know what they're like as people, superficially they're good looking, but they're really horrible. They're really awful human beings. But they came to LA. They wanted to make some sort of a career for themselves, maybe in the movies, maybe as actors, maybe as models. They had very grandiose plans for themselves. And so they decided to move here from Canada. So they moved to L.A. in the early 1980s. And actually the closest they ever got, I think, to being involved with anyone in Hollywood was they worked briefly as valets for Liberace.
never young, good-looking guys. I think I get what's going on there.
Yep, they were young, good-looking guys. Yep, they said that they were fired after they turned him down. Hard to say if that's true or not. These guys are not known for telling the truth, but you know, maybe yes, maybe no. But they decided just out of the blue that they were going to become film producers, and they attempted to raise money for a porn film project, and they earned the reputation as being, you know, like really quick to anger, completely unreliable. They finally did get a nibble from a potential backer, but they just blew it with being completely irresponsible. They did finally, though, make a porn movie, and it was called Kisses from Romania. They actually went to Romania to film it.
Are there some clips from this on YouTube?
I'm afraid there are.
That's what
they're
I thought.
They're not X-rated. A guy who considers himself an aficionado of porn, I did not even know that existed as a thing, but he described the women as not erotic at all. He said they conveyed hunger and poverty. So yeah. It's a depressing thing. Just the clips are depressing. Bottom line is that George and Stefan were really just complete failures in show business. So they ended up taking jobs as car salesmen. They lived in a bunch of small apartments. Finally, they moved to Marina Del Rey, really nice, on the waterfront. Probably around then, the first time that either one of the brothers really got into trouble for a sex crime was in the early 80s. The two brothers look the same, but there are, if you look at them carefully, there is a difference. George is the more, he's a little smaller, I think, physically than Stefan. Stefan, well, I think he might be taller, but Stefan maybe weighs 15 pounds more. And they do look alike. And if you weren't looking closely, you'd never be able to tell the difference. And it was Stefan who isn't, he was always described as being not quite as bright as George. He had impulse control issues,
And he was the first to get in trouble for any kind of sexual crime. And this was in the early 80s. But he lucked out three times. He was taken to court on different things. One time he was acquitted. I think he was twice acquitted. And the third time, the woman dropped the charges. And it turns out later that she'd been threatened.
This was a time in the 80s. This was what I call post-birth control and pre-AIDS. Things were a little bit looser, and it was people weren't as careful. And it was also a time for women before they we're seeing it today with this Harvey Weinstein thing and much more awareness of this date rape. In the mm-hmm. 80s, you never heard that term, date rape. I don't know when it was first kind of started to being used in the popular culture, but in the 70s, for sure, you never heard the word date rape. It was...
No, not at all. No, never.
I think Harvey Weinstein referred to it as the good old days.
You have to say that again, Eric.
Yeah, well, Harvey Weinstein, I just consider him a troll beneath my notice, frankly. But I don't think there was much conversation about it, probably really until the 1990s. And that's really when both of the twins got into trouble, and that's when they became known as the Rufy Romeos. What happened was it was about 1996, and they'd been getting away with this for a couple of years. What they would do is, because they were good-looking guys, and they had a nice line of patter if you didn't listen too closely. Otherwise, you could probably sense that they were lying about pretty much everything. They lied about who they were. They gave false names. They lied about what they did. One of the brothers said that he was Raquel Welch's personal trainer. Another one said that he had taught martial arts to Jean-Claude Van Damme. So they had really unbelievable notions of who they were in their fantasy lives. And so in the 90s, they were able to date women. I mean, they could go out to a club or something and start chatting up a woman, and they might even go out for a second date. But for whatever reason, I think it was power, control. I think it was the for kicks, they started drugging them, and they would slip a Rohypnol into a drink or something. And again, like I said, that will render a person just incapable of resisting anything. And so they started on this little spree probably in 1996. And finally a woman came forward. She went to one of the LA County Sheriff's substations, and she said, "Look, I think I've been sexually assaulted, but I'm not sure. I don't have a clear memory of it." But she was convincing enough, and her story was convincing enough that deputies from LASD went out to the with a warrant to the twins' apartment, and they found seven boxes of Rohypnol, which the twins said were for personal consumption. But it had already been made illegal in the United States by this time, probably a few months before that or a year before that. They had seven boxes of Rohypnol. And they had at least 20 video cassettes. And when the deputies looked at those, what they saw were filmed rapes, really. The twins had actually filmed the sexual encounters they'd had with these victims. It was just appalling. It was appalling. And the twins would mug for the camera. And they do what they called the Spitzer switch, which is, of course, I mean, I think you can see where I'm going with it. They'd switch, you know, one guy would start, another guy would finish.
They were twins.
They were really just twins.
Despicable.
They were just, you know, two little, just completely despicable.
Really? From a technical standpoint, I'm curious about this because, like, I have to plead ignorance anything about... roofies. How long does it take? If they would slip it in a girl's drink, get her to, they'd be buying her a drink or sitting there drinking with her. I guess was it already powder in a powder form where it would dissolve pretty quick?
Yeah.
And then
this is all pretty quick. It kicks in after about 30 minutes.
Okay.
And a couple of the women said they did notice some stuff at the bottom of their glass. So they didn't really think about it, you know. And a lot of times, if the Spitzers could get a woman over to their apartment, of course, it was much easier. If they were outside in a public place, because a lot of these, none of these women in these cases in the 90s, and there were 16 of them who came forward, none of them were dummies. I mean, they if they met them for a date, the women would take their own car, they'd meet them someplace public. You know, everything that you're supposed to do when you're meeting a stranger for a date. You know, oh, I'm in a public place, I brought my own car, so if I decide I don't like it, I can leave. But a lot of times what they do, you know, one of the twins would drug the woman, and then once it started to kick in, the woman would start to feel dizzy and unwell, and it would just look like she'd had too much to drink, and this nice date was escorting her outside.
Wow, that's...
So it was really, really difficult.
Did they ever trace back? Did they get the roofies from overseas?
Yeah, they had 7 boxes. No one needs 7 boxes of Rohypnol. I think they may have gotten it from overseas, or they had purchased it before it became illegal.
I would have to assume. I'd have to assume that even though it may be illegal in the United States, but I would have to assume that if you wanted to buy roofies and you knew anything about how to buy cocaine or marijuana or any kind of drugs, you can get them.
Oh yeah. Well, and you can still. I mean, you know, as you well know, there's plenty of international online pharmaceutical things where you can go. I mean, and buy pretty much anything you want. And then there's of course also the dark web, where if you know where you're what you're doing, you can get in and get, you know, you can make all kinds of illegal drug purchases and sales there. But even in the mid 90s, it wasn't a problem. And I think they'd probably purchased the Rohypnol before it became illegal, and they had 7 boxes. I mean, now I'm not sure how much to a box, but they could have gone on a long time before they hit the expiration dates on that stuff.
Well, and then, so then they videotaped themselves with these women. And, of course, when the police show up and they confiscate the 7 cases, I guess it would be of Rohypnol, and these videotapes, which are incredibly damning evidence, there must have been just a...
Oh, incredibly.
How many people, you know, you said there were 16 women that came forward?
16 came forward, but the twins, never at a loss for a lie, said that, yeah, you know, we made the videos, but they might have been made without consent. But, you know, they were engaged in consensual sex at one point, and the women were all having a good time, is what Stefan said. None of the women were having a good time. They were all unconscious. I mean, it was practically necrophilia. These women were not... They're non-responsive. They're the next best thing to dead. But all the women came from, I mean, they did, like I said, they came from all walks of life. I mean, there was a flight attendant. I think she might have been one of the last victims. A college student, a lawyer. I mean, just, you know, women, and fairly sophisticated. But these guys, once the woman was drugged, that was it. You know, but what the sheriff's department did, because they know that a lot of these cases, well, as you know too, Gary, a lot of these cases are difficult to prosecute because the victims are either ashamed or embarrassed to come forward, and in the cases of date rape drugs, a lot of times they're not even really sure, because I don't think Rohypnol stays in your system very long. So unless you think you've been assaulted and you go right away for a rape kit. Or if the guy wore a condom. I mean, there's a lot of stuff that can, it makes it a difficult, difficult prosecution.
Yeah, really difficult, especially when they can't.
The sheriff's department did. Yeah.
They started out consensual. These guys must have been charming and had a decent line.
They were very charming. They were very charming. But then they had like a switch that flipped on and off, you know, but the sheriff's department did finally put out a thing because they thought, okay, we have these tapes. These are really good, you know, in terms of evidence. These are damning, like you said. I mean, this is good stuff for a prosecution, but maybe we'll get some more victims if we put this out. And other women came forward and said, I always knew something had happened to me
you know, but I wasn't sure, you know, and then all the stories about I was ashamed, I was embarrassed. I didn't want to get someone in trouble if he hadn't done anything. And just all these mixed feelings. And in the end, 16 women came forward. There's one rule of thumb for a woman. If you do suspect that you have been drugged, pee in a cup right away.
Oh, and save good it. Advice.
Because if it cycles through your system, you may not be able to get somewhere in time for it to show up. And so these guys, I mean, they raped, like I said, 16 women came forward. The sheriffs thought that was just the tip of the iceberg. They said that we figure there are a lot more victims that just wrote it off as a chapter they'd rather forget or didn't really know that they'd been sexually assaulted. You know, so when these guys finally get to trial in 1998, the defense tried to portray them as just, you know, like boys will be boys. So these are just, but these weren't boys. They were like 40-year-old men. You know, they're not boys. The jury heard the case. They deliberated for a little more than a day, I think. And then they came back. They found both the twins guilty. Before they were sentenced, the twins addressed the judge and they said, look, none of the videotapes show a woman being drugged, even though it's evident from what's on the tape that the woman's not in control, and that none of the victims had produced a positive drug test. And I don't think that's really true, but the judge said he didn't care. He saw no signs of compassion or remorse and sentenced George to 60 years in prison and Stefan to 37 years. And until recently, I thought that's where it was left because the judge had made a statement that, you know, I want you guys in prison for as long as possible. When you're finally released, if you are, I want to make sure you can't harm another woman. I looked into the case a couple years ago. I found that one of the twins had already been released. And this was maybe 10 years later or something. And he'd already been released. And I thought, what the heck? I looked in the California Sex Offender Registry, and he wasn't there. And he would have been required by law to register as a sex offender. I couldn't figure out what was going on. I had to drop it for a while because I couldn't get any further with my search. And then I looked at it again fairly recently, and sure enough, both twins were out of prison. And what had happened was, for some reason, I don't know if it was prison overcrowding or what exactly caused them to be released after only 10 years, but they were released and then returned to Canada, which is their citizenship. Then as I looked into it, they've both been in trouble, not for sex crimes, not yet anyway. They've both been in trouble since in Canada. And as recently as last year, their neighbors, where they're living outside of someplace in Quebec, and their neighbors in the apartment complex were putting together a petition to have them outed. You know, just, we didn't know that's who they were. We had no idea. We don't feel safe. And one of the twins was also being charged in a fraud case. He defrauded a woman out of $100,000. So I knew when I first covered this story, initially I did it on television. And I knew at the time, I mean, and I'm sure, Gary, you know, too, when you're looking at somebody like this, you know they're going to reoffend. If they're out and they're in any kind of health, they're going to reoffend. There's no doubt about it.
That's for sure. Now, in Canada, do they have anything like the sexual predator laws like we have here where people are supposed to register or...
Yeah, is there a registry you can search?
Well, they have something like one of the twins was released into Canada on conditions. So there are conditions, apparently. And so that means it's sort of like an extended parole or probation kind of thing where they keep an eye on you to some degree. But I think it's George, some snafu, something went wrong in the paperwork or something, someone dropped the ball, and there are no conditions
wow.
on his release. So he's just wandering around in Quebec and, you know, near Montreal, I think, you know, without any conditions. But my feeling is at some point they're going to end up, they were both in jail on something. It wasn't clear for the newspaper exactly what. They were both in jail as recently as last year for something. And I haven't been able to find out exactly what that was and if it was adjudicated, how it came out. But these two guys are just, they're just, and then interestingly, when I wrote about the case, I heard from, I got a comment on the blog, and reading it, even though it said, it gave this name, and I looked up, I did a search on the address, and I found that it was originated in Canada,
mm-hmm.
and I could tell from the wording, it was one of the brothers.
Oh, really?
One of the brothers. And
they were Googling themselves.
Saying, yeah, they were. And he took umbrage to what I had to say about the twins, because as far as he was concerned, they were the two of the nicest, sweetest guys he'd ever known. So I wrote back to him and I said, first of all, if you're not one of the twins, I will be amazed. And secondly, I know that you're not nice guys. I know all about the case. I've read some of the trial transcripts. Pitch it any way you want, but I know what a dirtbag you are.
Mm.
And that ended our correspondence.
still having no remorse whatsoever.
Yeah, still no remorse whatsoever. Still like no, justifying.
Oh, yeah. Oh.
Working on Kisses from Canada.
Yeah, still blaming. Oh, no, I hope not.
Maybe they'll retitle it Creepy Kisses from Canada.
Well, I hope that the LAPD or somebody has alerted, I'm not sure who.
Yeah, you would think.
The RCMP is like the state police kind of up there.
You
and
know
then,
what? They did not. I heard from one of the victims. I did hear from one of the victims recently, just within the last month or so. And she said until she read my piece, she had no idea that they'd been released.
Huh.
And she said, I don't know why, you know, we weren't contacted, because the women who came forward, they were in court. Yes, they testified and they were in court. And during the sentencing, they all sat together and held hands and waited for the sentence to be handed down. So, you know, it's not like they should have been informed. And she said, no one told us. You know, I said, well, I'm tracking this. You know, I'm keeping my eye out on it. I know a couple people in the DA's office, and I'm going to see if I can find out if maybe someone could contact the other victims, because, I mean, this woman said she was, because they all, during the trial, they were only ever identified by first names and a last initial, which is as it should be. They shouldn't have been the ones who were being scrutinized, but they should have been informed that these guys were released.
Yeah, they should have
been. They're sexual predators.
Yeah, they are.
They're sexual predators, and they're not gonna stop behaving badly. I mean, they're just not. They're not. It's just who they are.
Maybe just thinking,
you know? And
in the moment that it was part of it, maybe when they did get paroled, because usually they have to have a plan when they go through their parole and go to a halfway mm-hmm. house or whatever. Maybe part of that was that they were going back to Canada, and so to some degree the. You know, the authorities thought, well, it's not going to be our problem anymore, which is unfortunate, but.
Yeah.
But really I can see that happening.
As we know,
I mean,
people can cross borders, you know, I mean, they can cross borders. If those two guys wanted to cross a border with a fake ID or something, I mean, it's not impossible.
Yeah.
I don't think they will. I think they'll stay in Canada because, I mean, there's plenty of victims in Canada, potential victims in Canada.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think just as a courtesy, that the victims here should have been notified.
Yeah.
I really do.
Well, that's that is quite a story and pretty topical, as I mentioned our friend Harvey Weinstein. I mean, it's just like him. You know, once you get one that comes forward and other victims find out about it, they all come forward. I was talking about this with a friend of mine today, and we were talking about even... you know, police departments, any business is not immune from kind of sexual power plays on the job, and police departments all have their share of it too. And I was telling this, she's a female police officer that had a little bit of problems herself, and I said, in my experience in 25 years, every time one woman came forward, and if it was a legitimate story, within a month, there would be two or three or five women that would come forward. And when they'd go investigate it, they will find exactly the same story with every victim. Exactly the same story, the same lines, the same language.
They repeat that M.O.
And so these guys will do exactly the same thing up there. They're just, I would say they're probably mm-hmm. keeping a lower profile and getting away with it. But if it ever pops up and hits the newspapers, you're going to find a bunch more victims, I would be, in my opinion, up there in Canada. They just don't quit.
No, I agree with you completely. I just think that they're not, I mean, you can just tell when, you know, when you're looking at the story and how many victims there were, just victims we are aware of, and you figure there are a lot more who never did come forward. That is a lot of women. And so, you know, and they felt they were good at it. Why would they stop something they felt they were good at? And especially when they have this notion that they're not guilty of anything, when they can actually look at a judge and stand up in court and say the women were enjoying themselves. These are two delusional human beings.
Really?
So, yeah, and it really is topical with the conversations going on now about, you know, about all the ways that sexual assault can happen. And, you know, it's just, it's really, really interesting. But these guys just, they just drug them to make them compliant. But as we know, there's other means of leverage, whether it's, you know.
Right, power in the workplace, but in a way that's
apart.
Right. That, I mean, any kind of power that you have, whether it be giving a woman a drug, whether she and she loses all of her power, whether you just have some situational power over them, and then mm-hmm. try to use that for compliance in the sexual arena, shall we say. It's the same thing. It's just slightly different details.
Yeah, we did an episode about an officer in Oklahoma, Holtzclaw, who was assaulting women. And he had his position of authority as an officer and pull him over on a dark road. And there was some really, the woman that we had a recording of describing what happened to her is really horrific to hear her actual, you could just feel and hear her emotion from that.
Anything, you got any other questions there, Aaron? We're getting ready to wind this up. We've been doing this a little over an hour now, and Aaron's frantically looking
well, I've
through.
I've your ear off.
Well, that's what we want. That's what we're selling, is you talking.
Oh, good.
Although we haven't got paid for it much yet, but we're selling it.
when people go out to your blog, is there any particular stories that you, besides this one, and maybe the Black Dahlia that you've written about, that you have a particular, you find it was like, it was one of, you felt like some of your best work?
What were your favorite stories?
I've written now like, I don't know, maybe over 300. And it's hard to say. I just find historic crime interesting. I mean, I used to just cover crime stories from maybe the 1910s through 1955 or so. I've expanded now to look at the whole 20th century, and just confining myself to Los Angeles and Southern California, I'll never run out of material. And they're all interesting. It's all. They're, each story that I select to write about, it tugs at me in some way. You know, there's one that's particularly creepy. His name was Harvey Glattman. He was executed, but this was in the 50s, as I recall, and he was pretending to be a photographer. And he would hire women as models, and then he would rape them and kill them. And he would take pictures all along the way.
Wow.
Some of the creepiest stuff I've ever had encountered. So, and he was finally executed.
Did the LAPD recover those pictures? Did the LAPD recover those pictures for use as evidence?
I believe they did. Yeah, I believe they did. I believe they did.
Yeah, we did.
And there was a survivor. There was a survivor. The last woman he tried this thing on, she realized that they were headed in a direction, you know, they were going the wrong way from where he told her they were going to go. And he pulled off on the side of the highway, and she started to struggle. He pulled out a gun. She actually grabbed, this is a gutsy lady, she grabbed the muzzle of the gun. It went off. It grazed her thigh. They roll out of the car. She's pounding on him. He's a little guy. She's pounding on him. And I think Highway Patrol rolled up or something. And at first they didn't know who the victim was, because she's beating this guy to a bloody pulp on the side of the road.
And then finally, you know, they get the story and they realize what's going on, and they arrest him. But it was, but so there was a survivor who was able to testify to,
well,
you know.
But then they must have like backtracked to where he lived, and then they find a whole bunch of the photography.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah, they did. Oh yeah. There was a lot of information. There was a lot of information. He was just a nasty little piece of work.
You know, my wife once said, she said, you know, she said, nobody will ever take me to a second location. I'll tell them I'll just die right here. Let's go. And that's what that woman did. She said, you know, we're not going any further. I'll die right here, or, you know, no more control shall you have over me. And I think that, for, you know, it's kind of hard to advise.
Yeah,
but
once you're in that, what if... Yeah. No, if the secondary location, you're dead. I mean, you're dead.
Yep.
You're dead. You're better off to try to get away or scream or something. Because yeah, once they remove you from that's it. You're gone. And it's scary. But people are, you know, people are still, you know, they're trusting. If you don't, I think people still want monsters to look like monsters, and they don't.
No,
they
like
don't.
Like these the Spitzer twins.
Part, they just don't.
Yeah, just like these twins. They didn't look or act like monsters.
No, and yet they're black hearted. They're awful, awful people. I can't even comprehend. I mean, they're just loathsome. And they look normal. And that's the thing. I mean, people, you know, people want to be able to trust, and so. You know, sometimes you realize afterwards, well, wait a minute, maybe I should have done that.
You know, that's the advice. I have, you know, being a police officer, I've had a lot of women ask me, you know, over my years about this kind of a situation. The main thing I say, just trust your instincts. If your instincts say get out of there, mm-hmm. if your instincts say there's something wrong, there's something wrong. Just go on. Don't try to be friendly or try to please them. Don't do anything. Just hurt your mm-hmm. feelings or whatever you got to do, just get away. Trust your gut.
Yeah, I think that's excellent advice, because most of the time there is that part of us that's still, you know, running away from woolly mammoths or something, you know, that instinct that we carry with us from the very beginning.
Aaron, did you have something?
I was just thinking, you know, of the Amityville Horror when the house goes, get out.
The Amityville Horror.
Exactly.
Now, if the house is telling you to get out, it's
exactly.
time to go. You know, if you hear that voice in the back of your head, I've been in that situation before, you know, where you're like, get out.
Yeah.
Just leave.
Hey, listen,
funny,
if the house
though,
starts
actually,
talking to
not.
Me, I know I'm in trouble.
Yeah, really.
I mean, one time I was working, I do comedy, I travel around the country, and I was hanging out at this house party in Minneapolis, and some girl passed out in the bathroom, and the guy goes in the bathroom supposedly to help her, and it took him 10 minutes. I don't think he was helping her.
Really?
The point that we're like, he's been in there for 10 minutes. That's not, like, something's not right.
Yeah, no. Something's definitely not right. That's when you kick the door in.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I think we've done this. Joan, I really appreciate you coming
really
on.
Pleasant. Thank you so much for inviting me.
We will. I will edit this. I'll let you know when it comes out. Probably.
Terrific.
I might even. I'm always looking for more listeners out there in the LA area. You know, you made a reference to my podcast once when I did the Two Tonys, Joe, and I got a little real ramp up in listeners from Los Angeles. That's such a huge population center.
Then, we'll pitch it, because yeah, everyone loves the Two Tonys case. I mean, that's a good one.
Yeah, I noticed
Tony
that.
Tony Trombino and Tony Brancato.
So I will probably
never,
even.
They were never better than when they were dead.
Yeah, really. Never better than when they were dead. That sounds like a James Elroy line to me. Is that or did you make that one up? You made that one up. Kudos to you.
I made that one up. I made
good.
That one up. I spent a lot of time in his company. I think it rubbed off.
God, I'd love to get him on the show sometimes, but those stars like that, they're a little bit, you got to go through agents and they don't have much time. So,
yeah. And he's very protective of his time.
Yeah.
Because he works so hard. I mean, he really does.
You have any appearances on TV coming up that you know of?
I just had one the other night, and I think it's gonna replay. I forget what channel it's on. It's something to do with the Cecil Hotel in Los Angeles, so I don't know. I think it's showing someplace on Investigation Discovery Channel, but I'm not sure. I never watch myself. That's my rule of thumb. You don't need to do that. To me, it's like you've done it. You already know what you said. You did it. You don't have to see it. So I don't watch myself. So I usually hear from somebody else. Oh, I saw you on TV the other night. Oh, okay.
Yeah, I agree. And once in a while, I'll listen to our podcast, but I don't listen to everyone. It drives me nuts. After I've edited it, I've listened to it, I've said it, I've listened to it while I edit it.
Yeah, by then, you know, Oh, yeah, listening to the ad, doing the edit, that can take a long time. And then you've got everybody, you know what you said, and you can speak along with everybody else who was talking.
Well, we will let you go on about your business out there in sunny Los Angeles, California, and I will let you know when we put this up. Joan, I appreciate you coming on the show. It's a very interesting story, and maybe help somebody. I know it's an ongoing concern. I've noticed young women today, Or when they go into a bar, they watch their drink, or they make sure somebody else watches their drink. All right, you got anything else, Aaron?
It is.
I think that's it.
All right, good night, Joan.
Well, thank you so much. Good night to you
good
too.
Night. Bye.
Take care. Be safe.
We will. You too.
Thank
Bye.
You. Bye.
Well, Aaron, that was a little bit different than what we usually do. A little bit creepy and a little bit scary, especially for young women out there. But it's kind of I do my little public service announcement for people who have problems with drugs or alcohol. Well, this will be a whole public service show for young women who are out and about and in the social world and bars and places like that and going out on dates. I don't do that anymore. I haven't done that in quite a while.
Well, you have you go out and you've read her blog, Deranged LA Crimes.
Right, I have. I read several of the things. She's a good writer. She really writes well.
You know, my question I wanted to ask, which I kind of alluded to there, was, how do you get that job as a volunteer at the LA Police Museum? Going through all that material, I'd just be.
That would be something. It would be. Well, I'll tell you what, if you want to go out and volunteer your time.
Just to take some of that work home, so to speak. I bring it back.
They would actually vet her a little bit. She's got some contacts on the LAPD. We didn't really go into that, but she's got some kind of contacts on the LAPD that she works with and that know her. Otherwise, they wouldn't be putting her into that position. She probably has done other volunteer things with the PD or just got a really good friend on the PD that has some position of power that can put her into that.
I mean, that if you want to be like, if you're into crime,
or
you're writing a blog.
Yeah, really.
About crime in L.A., you know, that would be the perfect job there.
It would.
Just go up to the police department and go, I'd like to volunteer. Don't you have like a historical department with photographs and records and... I would love to help you there.
Yeah, well, thank God that she did do that, because she can put out on the internet so we can all read about those old 1950s crimes. And she's got a few photos on there. She doesn't go crazy with them, but she's got a few photos on there.
And then now she's working with the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Museum.
Right.
It's got to be some great history there.
Yep. If you have a friend or relative with a problem with drugs or alcohol, make your first call to First Call. Call 816-361-5900 or go to their website, www.firstcallkc.org. What do you got to say to that, Aaron?
I got to say, folks, you need to go out and get the documentary that started it all, Gangland Wire, available on Amazon to buy. And then you want to get the Kansas City Mob Tour app. For $1.99, you can download to your iPhone an app that will let you know when a podcast comes out, and you can take your own personalized tour of notorious mob locations in and around Kansas City. Then you're going to want to go and get the new book that Gary just wrote, Leaving Vegas.
How FBI wiretaps ended the mob domination of Las Vegas casinos.
Now you're going to want to read those words that the men said, and then you're going to want to get the Kindle version, which I think is like another $1.99. Maybe.
Yeah, but oh, I don't. You know, if you buy the
book,
you can get it for 99 cents. Oh,
that's a deal, even better.
I think it's $44.99 for the Kindle only, I believe, but I'm not. I can't remember.
Yeah. But the Kindle, unlike the book, where you're reading the words, the Kindle has the actual words from the mouth of the men that did it. It's hyperlinked video with a transcription and those notorious mob icons of Kansas City skimming in Vegas talking about it. And you can hear it from the mouth of the men that did it, from Gary Jenkins. Gangland Wire.
You know, Aaron, I think maybe I can finally get my app up on Android. Amazon, I haven't got into it yet, but Amazon has a new way to drag and drop and do
an app.
I'm really snowed under with this and some work that actually pays me some money right now, but I think in the next couple of weeks I'm going to take a look at that, and from what I can read, I can get that done and get it up on Android
through Amazon.
Buy it at the Amazon store. I think it's time to get out of here. Say goodnight, Aaron.
Goodnight, Aaron.
Bumper music provided by Odd-O-Matic. Follow them on Twitter at Odd-O-Matic Music.
Noticing also that you've been working on this book about this reporter, Aggie Underwood, or is that...
I have. I've been working on it for a while. You know how it goes. I had a couple of publishing offers, and they were pretty atrocious, really, so I declined them.
Yeah.
Because it seems like they want you to sign away everything you've ever had or ever will have, and that doesn't strike me as a good deal for me.
Right.
So now I'm thinking I might go back to plan A, which was self-published. So the book is pretty much finished. And now it's just a matter of getting the wherewithal to go ahead and just publish it myself and be done. Because I love the woman I've written about. Her name is Aggie Underwood, and she was a crime reporter in Los Angeles, and she got her start in the late 20s and worked as a crime reporter. Very unusual for a woman. Not that there weren't any, but there weren't many. And she worked as a reporter from the late 20s until really the Black Dahlia case was the last case she covered as a reporter. And then she was promoted to city editor at the Evening Herald and Express. It was a William Randolph Hearst newspaper. And she stayed there for the remainder of her career as a city editor. Fascinating woman, fascinating life. All the major crimes in L.A. from late 1920s till 1947, she covered as a reporter. And just interesting stuff. Really great story, I think, her story.
Yeah, that would be. May have to have you come back and talk about her and your book, actually. That is, right now I'm in the middle.
Oh, I would love to.
I'm in the middle of doing a kind of a series called The Media and the Mob, and I've been interviewing mob reporters from around the United States. Of course, I've got a couple.
Oh, that sounds great.
No, here in Kansas City. Then
that's terrific.
We got old Bulldog John Drummond up in Chicago, who is an icon in Chicago, and got a guy named Dave Schratweiser, who reports on Philly, and I've got a woman, Emily Sweeney, from the Boston Globe that's calling in next week. So.
Yeah, a couple guys from the Kansas City Star.
Oh, that's right. Terrific.
So anyhow, we're...
That's just terrific. That's fascinating. I love that stuff. I think reporters and cops have a lot in common.
Yeah,
you know,
we do.
They're both observers. You know, you have to be able to size up a person fairly quickly and decide how you're going to approach them. And just, I think it's interesting.
And try to get to the truth of a story among competing, maybe...
Yes. Yeah.
Sets of information and then try to come out with what is the real story here and then convey it to somebody else in an understandable manner. That is the to me the most similarity there is between coppers and reporters.
Yeah.